Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, this is Joanna Penn for the Creative Pen Podcast, and today I'm interviewing Scott Sigler. Scott is the New York Times best-selling author of Infected and Contagious, and his new book, Ancestor, which is out on June 22nd, all published by Crown. Before being published, Scott podcasted his novels for free, building up a huge fan base for his writing, and still podcasts regularly now. So welcome, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here finally. People have been asking for you for so long now.
Great, wonderful.
So maybe you could tell us just a bit more about your publishing journey, because, you know, right now you seem to be everywhere with trailers and books and massively successful. But was it always this way?
No, not at all. I spent a good, I would guess a good 11 or 12 years writing every day and trying to get published through the traditional channels of soliciting agents and publishers and going to all the writing conventions and trying to meet people. And ran into a lot of resistance, I think, in the first few years because I wasn't very good. And then probably 5 to 12 years into it, I was getting much better. But, the rejection letters I got at that point were usually the same thing, which is we don't know what shelf to put it on. We don't know whether to sell it as horror, sci-fi, is it thriller, is it suspense, is it action? And that's not something that traditional publishing wants to touch very often, any kind of cross-genre type story. So I plugged away for all that time and then found out about podcasting back in 2005. And the first thing that popped in my head was, this is a great way to serialize a novel. It'll be just like the radio dramas of the 40s and 50s. Went looking for books to listen to via podcast. And when I couldn't find any, I realized it was because nobody had done it yet. No one had put one out at that point, although coincidentally three people were all working on it at the same time. Myself, T. Morris with his book Moravi, and Mark Jeffrey with his book The Pocket and the Pendant. But when I found out nobody had done it yet, then the marketing part of my brain kicked in and I was in a real hurry to record and get a podcast novel out there and try and capitalize on being first to market. That led to several thousand followers listening to the podcast. And when I put out a book, the first time Ancestor came out was in 2007, trade paperback from a really small Canadian imprint called Dragon Moon Press. But when that book came out, despite having no marketing budget, no PR, no media coverage of any kind, no advertising, it was the number two fiction novel on Ancestor the day it came out. And that was, it was only there for a few days, but it's still a pretty big accomplishment. And then that got New York houses fired up that somebody could do that on their own, and led to the book deal with Crown.
No, that's fantastic. And I'm interested there about the cross-genre thing, because when I first heard about you, which was sort of, you know, last year, and I talked to J.C. Hutchins, and, you know, the names get around, and, you know, you kind of introduced as a horror writer, but as you say, I don't really like horror very much, but I really got into your books because they're not, like, pure horror, are they? Can you explain that a bit more?
They're not, and the biggest influences on my writing are horror writers, and, you know, like Stephen King and Dean Koontz, but most of the horror writers out there use supernatural fiction and kind of make up the environment as they go along for whatever fits the story. So while I like those stories, that never really resonated with the scientific part of my brain, so I write what I call hard science horror. So these are, like most horror stories you see, it's modern day. It's people like you and me in current settings with current socio-political things going on around them. And there is some kind of hard science element introduced to it, which is where people sometimes tag me as sci-fi. And then that normal setting with that hard science background takes the story into a terrifying place where the characters are in grave jeopardy and have to figure out how to get out of that and how to save the day if they're able to get out of it at all. A lot of my characters die in the story. So that's what brings us all the way back around to horror. So I sort of now see the difficulty the publishers had, because they, even my current publisher Crown, sometimes they market me as a thriller writer. Sometimes they market me as a horror writer, and it's just not, it's not a well-trodden path to put all those things together. I mean, there are people who've done it, definitely, like Michael Crichton or Douglas Preston Lincoln Child, but it's not like you will find a shelf of hard science horror anywhere in a bookstore.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so wanted to ask you, I guess you mentioned your 11 to 12 years of slogging away there, which is obviously key to your success. But do you have any other recommendations for people who want to become New York Times bestselling authors?
Well, I think the biggest thing now is with the affordability and accessibility of all the tools online, it is to write every day, create the best story you can, edit the story heavily, because you only get one chance for people to hear your story, where they'll turn you off and never come back to you again. Outside of that, which hasn't changed in hundreds of years worth of fiction writing, it's get your content out online and start building up an audience. The days of being discovered, I believe, are completely gone. The days of someone pulling your manuscript out of a slush pile and like, oh my goodness, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Those are totally gone. There will still be random lightning bolts that strike, and people, you know, one in a million will make it through the traditional model. But I think where things are going to now is if you can get your stories online, give them away, build an audience and interact with that audience, and you will get to a point where you bring that audience to a publisher. So instead of saying, I know my book will sell because this is just the best thing ever, you're going to publishers saying, I know my book will sell because I've got 50,000 people reading my blog every day. There's a huge difference there. And publishers now are starting to understand this as well. So instead of them just taking a chance based on their own taste or on the taste of some English professor at some college who's dubbed the student, you know, this is a very important work, et cetera, now publishers can sit back and look at what's resonating out in the marketplace. And you got to remember, publishers are risking an enormous amount of money with every book that they publish. People's jobs are on the line with every book that comes out. If you were in their shoes, most people are going to be more apt to go with more of a sure thing to mitigate that risk. And the way they can mitigate that risk is look to see who's out online building up an audience and already has people that like their work. Those are the people that publishers are going to start signing and putting promotional money behind.
Mm. And so you're actually seeing that now. Are you in the, you know, up in the pro publishing industry, I guess?
I am. I'm a little unlucky because my agent is Bird Level of the Waxman Agency in New York. And he's sort of part of his business plan is to go out and find people online who have built up audiences and then try and figure out how to turn that into a book deal. I mean, he represents me. He represented the gentleman who wrote Tucker Max, who wrote I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell, which started out as strictly a blog and was turned into an incredibly successful book that's still on bestseller lists and still on every airport in America, at least. And a new one, gentleman who just tweets under the name Shit My Dad Says. Mm. And they've, you know, this has become a phenomenon, and Bird represents him and figured out how to say to publishers, look, this guy's a huge online audience. The content he's putting out is resonating with people. Let's figure out how to put out a book together. And they did, and that's going to do very well. So yeah, and this is a new trend that is happening in pro publishing, and it should happen because it just flat out makes sense. You know, you can find someone, a publisher who likes your book, but still, at the end of the day, they have to look at that and make a business decision. And if you have thousands of people following you online, that's a much more logical risk for them to take than someone who hasn't built up any kind of following at all.
Mm, absolutely. And when you're talking about that, I mean, you mentioned 50,000 there, which was, you know, a number. But, I mean, clearly you spend a lot of time with promoting and podcasting. And also you seem to be an incredibly prolific writer. So how do you balance all of those things as well as real life?
Real life a lot of times has to take a backseat with all of the stuff that I'm doing. It's been kind of a 5-year marathon since I started this podcasting process. And Early on, I made a commitment that I was going to put out content every week, because then it's more like a regular TV show or a weekly radio show. And that in Western culture, a lot of times that's what people are used to. They get their content every Monday. They listen to, you know, National Public Radio every Sunday, et cetera. And if you can match that output schedule, then people are much more apt to follow you every week, become a big fan, expect your content and start to spread the word. So it's a little bit of the cart before the horse, in that I have to put stuff out every week. So I've modified my writing schedule to make sure that I've got some kind of content coming into the pipe every week. That really has drastically increased my productivity. I'm writing more stuff, better stuff than before, because I do need to feed that monster that I have created. And things will probably slow down a little bit after Ancestor, which is already out in Australia, is out in the U.S. and Canada June 22nd, and then is out in the U.K. in August. Be able to sit back and look at bigger projects and figure out what we're going to do from there.
Mm. And I wondered, so you said the 5-year marathon there, which is since you've been podcasting, were you sort of working a regular job as well when you started this sort of writing, podcasting every week?
Yeah, I was. I was doing social media marketing for two companies during the first 3 years of this process, as I was building up an audience and putting out content every week. And I was also oddly fortunate that I had spent those 12 years trying to get published, because I had 4 finished edited novels. So when I started podcasting, I had 4 complete novels that I gradually podcast over the course of those 3 years. So I was able to keep content in it every week. And then when I got to the point where I signed the deal with Crown and made the decision to go full-time as an author, the full-time job went away, and then kind of the full-time self-marketing kicked in from there. So started out with a full-time job, a day job, and now it's writing and doing my website and the podcast and the marketing. So I figured, I pretty much have 3 full-time jobs right now.
Yeah. And I think that's really important for people to hear, because, you know, you do write an awful lot. I mean, you seem to be writing all the time, and yet you are also promoting, and it's hard work, isn't it? What you do, it's not just sitting back writing all the time, being happy.
No, it's not. And I find this now that I'm getting to meet more people who are full-time authors. Yet everybody needs to remember that the Stephen Kings, Dean Koontz's, Stephanie Meyers, and J.K. Rowling's are this ridiculously small percentage of what actually goes on out there. You know, the top 30 or 40 New York Times bestsellers are all making a pretty good living, and they get to do nothing but write. Everybody below that, you know, upper or lower level bestsellers, mid-list authors, beginning authors, it's a bigger job. It's not just the writing. You have to get out there and market and do your own thing. You learn pretty quickly that however much a publisher loves your work, you are one of 40 or 50 books that's coming out for that publisher every month, and they only have so many resources to market your work, and no one's going to have the passion to market your work the way that you are. So it is. It's the full-time writing is also basically a full-time marketing job. You have to control your own website, make sure things are accurate on there, make sure it's accessible to people, learning how to use social media tools like Facebook and Twitter, and getting out there and engaging with the audience. There's quite a lot of work to be done to try and get to that upper level where the fans are all coming to you.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, so I just want to ask you about podcasting, because, I mean, you know, clearly you've been doing it a long time, and, you know, J.C. Hutchins put out a post, you know, a few weeks ago about maybe not doing it anymore. You know, is podcasting still something you recommend for authors who want to build a platform, or are there more effective methods?
I think it is the most effective method. It's also the most work. And the reason it's the most effective method is because the author is reading his or her own work and gets to preface each episode with, hey, here's what's going on in my writing life. And then at the end of the episode, they can just ramble on as long as they want. So it becomes an audio blog that establishes your personality and you as a human being, in addition to giving out your stories. And that audio connection is what in all cultures is what people identify with quite frequently. If you can hear someone's voice and hear the passion in their voice for what they do, that person ceases to become just some author and becomes this friend that you listen to every week. It's extremely powerful. It makes for lifelong fans, and there's really no substitute for it. However, it is also the most work, because not only are you writing, you are recording, then you have to edit your recording, and then you have to get, you have to understand how to post and how to podcast and how to interact with people from there. So it's the most work. The step down from that, which also works extremely well, I think, is blogging your writing, be that fiction or nonfiction. There's a gentleman named David Wellington who wrote a book called Monster Island, and he blogged that book and was able to build up a following and turn that into a print deal. And now he has many books out, 13 Bullets, Frostbite, Monster Island, Monster Nation. And so he just writes great content. He gave it away for free online and built up an audience that way. So that's the second method I would suggest, because, and that's very beneficial because people who are very busy with jobs and families and are still trying to write, you're doing the writing part anyways. Taking that writing and putting it up in a blog post is a very minimal amount of work. So you cut out that whole audio production side of things, and then you're still out there online and you still have to spend the time promoting and interacting with your audience. But it's a good alternative method to podcasting. However, if people have the time or they really want to create a crazy fan base, I still think podcasting is the way to go.
Mm. And I guess one question a lot of people have is, but if I put my stuff out online, that would jeopardize a publishing deal and people will steal it. These are the things that people still say.
Right. People still say that. And I think that people can let go of the whole fear of the publishing deal, because this just comes back to common sense. If you build up an audience online, 5,000, 10,000 people, say you put out your own indie book, right? And you sell 2,500 copies of your indie book and you can go show that to a publisher. Publisher A may go, oh, you've compromised your first printing rates. There's going to be publisher B, C, and D who are like, gimme. You know, publishing is desperate for things that are already proven. And you can see that instantly from any kind of fiction that comes out that is successful, from the dozens to hundreds of clone books that come out immediately after it. You know, publishing does not want original ideas. They want stuff they know is going to sell. So I really think that people can let that go. It's a different world. It's not the same world it was 10 years ago. It's not even the same world it was 5 years ago. If you put something out and you have an audience and it sells, you will find a publisher who wants to put that out. As far as people stealing your ideas, you know, that's another common concern. And I used to have that concern. You know, I used to be registering my screenplays and mailing them to myself and copywriting them and doing all of this extra work to prove that I had it, had the idea first. And the bottom line is, I won't say that there are no original ideas, because there are, but there's really nothing you can do. If someone from a big publishing house steals from you, unless they actually copy the words down verbatim, that's a battle you can't win in court anyways, because they have more money than you do. And so it's really a minor concern, and it's a cost benefit ratio. The cost of you not putting out your stuff and making sure that no one's going to rip you off is, the only people who are going to read your stuff ever are maybe agents and maybe some 19-year-old intern at the publishing house who's tasked with going through 100 manuscripts a day in the slush pile. The benefit to it, to outweigh the risk, is that you are getting your content in front of an end listener or an end reader, people actually out in the marketplace who will get excited about your work and go out and talk about it, and then word of mouth will bring you more fans. And the final thing I'll say about that is related to something. There's a blogger for Boing Boing and an author. His name is Cory Doctorow. And Cory's been giving away his stuff for free for 5+ years as PDFs online, just gives his whole book away for free. And people have brought up the same question to him. Aren't you afraid that people will rip you off, or aren't you afraid people are going to pirate it and give away your work, costing you that sale? And Corey's awesome quote is, piracy is not my enemy, obscurity is my enemy. He doesn't really care if people rip it off and copy it and put it on BitTorrents and give it away, because even if people out there who get that stuff for free, that's another chance for him to convert a new fan and turn that fan into a paying customer that he wouldn't have had if the stuff wasn't pirated in the first place. So for aspiring authors who are trying to get a publishing deal, your biggest enemy is obscurity. How are you going to cut through the clutter to actually get a publisher to read your book and to be actually read it with a fair mind where they're considering it for publication? And one way to do that is to build up an audience. So I don't worry about those things anymore. I have been ripped off a couple of times. There's a couple of movies out there that are just blatant ripoffs of stuff I've given away free as a podcast. So I can speak from both sides of the story. Yes, I have been ripped off. Is it annoying and frustrating? Incredibly so. But at the same time, I also have a print deal with the subsidiary of Random House, and I'm selling books and doing okay. So it's cost benefit evaluation.
And And yeah, I mean, and as I said, I mean, I heard of you, I listened to one of your free podcasts, then I, you know, bought another audiobook and now I'm a fan and now I'm talking to you. So, you know, and I probably wouldn't have found you down here in Australia without that. So it's absolutely.
The other thing people have to consider is, you know, again, you can't be going off the model of 10 years ago or 15 years ago, because 15 years ago, there was almost no internet. There was fewer TV channels. There was not, you know, a movie theater had one movie and that was all it had, not five, six, or seven. Video games weren't anything like they are now. Now, as an author, you are trying to compete in the entertainment space against the biggest entertainment juggernaut in human history, which is the video games. It makes more than money. Movies, the internet, TV, all of these different things that just weren't there before. So yeah, so by giving my stuff away, people will look at that, well, I could go buy this video game or I can just listen to this audiobook for free and see if I like it first. You're going to get more people trying out your stuff, and you're going to get people trying out your stuff before you're in stores. And then that once you're in a store, you are one book of 150,000 sitting on the shelf. And how are people going to find you?
No, absolutely. Okay, so I just, you know, you mentioned, you know, putting indie books out there, and I'm interested in your sort of model now, because you've done two books, The Rookie and The Starter, as sort of small print run special editions, because I think your publisher wasn't interested in those books. Is that true? And why did you do that model?
Well, the books that Crown puts out, Infected, Contagious, Ancestor, are, you know, modern day horror thrillers. And The Rookie is an American gridiron football league 700 years in the future with aliens playing different positions based on their body type. And I describe it as Star Wars meets Any Given Sunday meets The Godfather. So it's a drastic departure from what Crown is trying to brand me as. And they just think that's not the kind of books that we sell. I was like, all right, do you guys mind if I put it out myself? And they had no problem with that. So since I had that book finished, I wanted to put it out and see how it would do. And the business model there is I have built up this online audience, and I've given away this story, The Rookie, for free. So I went to the online audience that I've got. I'm going to put this out as a special edition in hardcover with 16 color pages inside to show you all the different parts of the story. Who wants to pre-order this? And we were able to pre-order The Rookie the first day. We sold about 1,000 copies in pre-order, and that gave us the capital to go out and do a 3,000 copy hardcover print run and not have to use the print on demand technology. So now our goal is to put out one rookie book a year. My partner A. Kovacs and I and our company Dark Overlord Media, we put out one book a year there, and then trying to write one book a year over for Crown as well. So I'm really lucky because I get the best of both worlds. I've got a big publisher and in all the bookstores with the modern day thrillers, and then I get to write, you know, as a big fan of American football my whole life, I get to write this crazy science fiction sports book, put it out on my website, and the diehard fans who want it, they track it down.
And that's interesting there, because you talked about brand. You're just using your name, aren't you? You're not splitting your name in any way.
No, and I probably would have for this, because if I had things to do over, I probably would have Scott Sigler as the brand for the modern day horror thrillers and then come up with some other random name for the sports stuff, just not so as not to confuse the brand. But since I podcast The Rookie 3 years ago as part of my regular podcast, there's no way I can do that now. So it is what it is. When you put out everything you write as a podcast first, it's already associated with your name. So there's not really a way to have a pen name.
And do you think that sort of mixed publishing option is the way people will go?
I really do. I think that, you know, there are some people who could do this, the Stephen Kings, the Stephanie Meyers, et cetera. I mean, if Stephanie Meyers was to say, for whatever reason, want to do her own small collection of Twilight short stories and just publish, hire a couple people to manage it for, sell it only on pre-order and publish it for, you know, $40 a copy, she would literally make, you know, $7-9 million like overnight. And whether that's of importance to the people who are at that level or not, I don't know, but the numbers add up and that they could make a ton of cash and write exactly what they want and send it right to their audience. So that, when you look at that, that's probably a model that somebody's going to do in the near future. Probably Stephen King would be my guess, because he seems to be ahead of the curve on everybody on everything at that level, as far as trying out new things. But then for the mid-list authors, it becomes a very powerful thing, because maybe you aren't selling enough copies with Simon and Schuster to merit them paying any attention to you, and then there's a new boss, and your editor leaves, and your publicist leaves, and all of a sudden you're left in a lurch with five books that they're not really pushing. You know, you've got an audience out there. If you're able to collect that audience online and connect with them online, the diehard people find you online, you're in touch with them, then you put out your own book in addition to the books that are coming out from the publisher. That's a direct author to audience connection. You cut out the middleman. Mm. So the analogy that I use is, I make 10% on the books I sell with Crown, and then I make, 80% on the books I sell by myself, but I sell 10 times as many books with Crown as I do by myself. So it's kind of a wash, but it really is diversifying. Number one, it gets authors their own revenue stream and their own brand that they control, just in case things go south at the publisher, which happens quite a lot. You know, at least now you've got something to fall back on and focus on, and then you're handling your own brand and your own business on that side. And for a lot of authors, I think they'll be able to have the best of both worlds, do both of those things, and I hope it works out where they keep money coming in.
Mm. That's fantastic. It's very encouraging for those of us who sort of like doing it ourselves as well. It's sort of that you can have both ways, and you can make more of a living and have more of a business, I guess, that way.
Yeah. And it still goes back to developing an audience, though. I mean, the only reason I can get away with selling 3,000 copies in hardcover at $35 a pop for The Rookie is because I've given so much stuff away online and keep people entertained every week that when I say, hey, I've got this story that, 20,000 of you love so much, what percentage of you would actually want a really keepsake hardcover? And that turns out to be, X percent, and you sell those books. So it's still about being online in some capacity on a regular basis and engaging your fans and building an audience.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, well, let's talk a bit about Ancestor, because I loved Infected and Contagious, and I know this is a bit different. I mean, I have pre-ordered my copy on the Kindle. It doesn't come out on the Kindle here until the 22nd as well. So can you tell us a bit about Ancestor?
Ancestor is it's kind of a summer blockbuster movie in book format. It is the story of a biotech company that is trying to perfect xenotransplantation, which is taking animal organs and using them to replace failing human organs. So this is a technology that we can actually do right now, and it does work. You can take a pig heart, put it in a person, and that heart will function and would keep the person alive, except for this crazy biological fact we have that our own immune system attacks that organ. So our own immune system kills the thing that would otherwise keep us alive. And that is called the immune response. And biotech companies are trying to get around that right now. And one of the ways, in the book, the way the company gets around that is to digitize and sequence the genome of all mammals. Basically come up with the ancestor of all mammals and then use that in silico to evolve the mammal in a computer and then print out the DNA, actually print out the proteins in real time. Insert that into an animal egg, put that into a host, and let that creature grow and gestate to birth. And then the goal is, hey, we're going to get this 200-pound herd animal that'll reproduce. We'll put it out to pasture, and then it'll be just like harvesting sheep or cows. We'll be able to harvest these things for their organs, save millions of lives every year, and make billions of dollars. But being a science that goes horribly wrong type story, instead of this 200-pound herd animal, they wind up with about a 650-pound pack predator. And they, being a horror story, you got to have your isolation. So they are trapped in an area where they can't get out, and they have to deal with these creatures who are extraordinarily hungry because they have very rapid growth rate, and they have to eat constantly to stay alive. So if you're a fan of Aliens or Predator or Jurassic Park, Relic, books along those lines, then I think people would really enjoy it.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. I'm looking forward to it. But you've also done this sort of brilliant book trailer, recently in the last week, I think. Can you tell us a bit more about that? Because it's like a movie trailer. Why did you do it in that way?
Well, book trailers are coming on as a way to market. There's so many people on YouTube and on websites and blogs, And a major element of movie marketing now is getting clips of that movie and getting it out to the blog so that people can see it. Because just movies, just like everybody else, are trying to cut through the clutter and get people's attention. So with a book, you know, I can give away a couple sample chapters. Are people going to get those and read those? I don't know. But if it's a 60-second or 2-minute trailer, the culture is being so ingrained into YouTube that people can see the player, see how long the player takes to play, see the frozen image before they play, and like, oh, this will only take 2 minutes. And they watch it. And that gives you your chance to communicate the message and feel of the book to someone who otherwise would not go out and pick up that book. That's really what a book trailer is about. It's about converting the people who otherwise would not go into a bookstore, would not find your book. But if you do this trailer, and in this particular case, it's movie quality. We went up into the mountains in California to shoot it in the snow. We have full CGI monsters in it to really try and get people's attention so that they will consider going out and buying that book. So the better you can make a trailer look, the better off you are. And even if you can only just make a basic trailer, doing that gives you a chance to go get customers who otherwise would never hear of you. And the final thing about it is these things last forever. They're like evergreen, where any print ad you make is going to go away. Any ad on a blog is going to go away, but these trailers sit up on YouTube and continue to produce views for you as they get indexed in all different kinds of ways. The Infected trailer is now 2.5 years old and still gets 40 or 50 views a day. So yeah. I've still got 40 or 50 people stumbling onto that every day and seeing if they watch it. And out of those 40 or 50, some people are going to watch it, like the book, go buy the book, and then they wind up watching my other trailers and buying my other books. So a good trailer stays online forever and continues to sell books for you long after all other marketing efforts that you could even think of are gone.
Mm. And do you think, you know, being more like a movie, are you angling also for a movie deal, you know, through a book trailer almost?
I really am. And that's one of the things we were going after with Ancestor was, you know, so many books get optioned. And many more don't get optioned, but more movies seem to be getting made now from graphic novels than from straight text books. Because I had Infected optioned, was able to go down to Hollywood and meet with several different people in the industry and try to get Infected made. We didn't get it made. The rights are back to me and I'm starting over again. But that experience taught me that these are incredibly busy people. Mm. And they are looking at literally 20, 30, 40 different properties at a single time. And they're trying to go out and get, you know, they're trying to get $20 million worth of funding to make a movie. It's not just that they're considering properties. There's this massive business case they have to put together for everything. So they're swamped. I mean, they are just unbelievably swamped. But if you can put a graphic novel in front of them that's 100 pages, they can flip through that. And that's basically a storyboard for a movie. Now they understand the bigger picture of the movie and how it will translate into that medium, and they have much more conviction to go out and get it made. Plus, it helps them go out and they can give that graphic novel to the people with the money. Here, read this. It'll take you 2 hours, and you'll immediately see the whole movie. Mm. They can't do the same thing with a 500-page novel, and they can't do it with 30 500-page novels. You know, it's just not scalable for them. So the graphic novels are doing very well for that reason. And then the movie trailer, the book trailer that looks like a movie, is specifically aimed at even a shorter attention span than that. They should be able to see my book trailer, immediately get the gist of what kind of movie that would make, and that's what gets them interested, and that's like my lead element now, so that they can look at that and go, yes, I happen to be looking for genetically engineered monster stories because of this production deal I have. This is exactly what I need right here. And then they can extend the contact from there. So it does serve a couple of different purposes.
Mm, fantastic. And I'll put the video on the show notes so people can see that. Okay, so we're out of time. How can people find out more about you and your podcasts and your books? And where can they get Ancestor, I guess?
The place to go to find out about me is scottsigler.com, which is scottsigler.com. That is where I give away all of my podcasts. The current podcasts, the back podcasts, are at a site called podiobooks.com, which is podiobooks.com. For ordering information for Ancestor, just go to scottsigler.com/ancestor, and that's available Barnes and Nobles, amazon.com, any of those online sites, and is available in bookstores everywhere. It's available right now in Australia. It came out first in Australia and then will be available in the US on June 22nd.
Fantastic. Thanks ever so much for your time, Scott. That was brilliant.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time.